Blog Talk Radio.
Discussion of the dynamic and volatile world of writing, publishing, and marketing of the written word. I'm your host, Robert Batista. Today's exciting guest is the author, poet, publisher, and so much more, Tony Nesca. Welcome, Tony Nesca, to the Author's Lab.
Hey, Robert, how are you?
Hey, Tony, all the better for hearing your voice, man. Tony, let me just start off and say that it's so wonderful reconnecting with you. So I'll open with asking you to educate those first-timers tuning in on your long list of accomplishments and your background.
Sounds good. Let her rip.
Go ahead, Tony.
Sorry, Robert. I can't hear you well.
So can you hear me? I'm just asking you to go over your background. Just update us.
Okay, I got you now. I started Screaming Skull Press in 1994, writing and publishing my own work. I've written 18 books of novels, stories, and poems. In 2008, my wife, Nicole Sabella, now Nicole Nesca, moved to Canada from the United States, and she joined Screaming Skull Press, and she has her own. She's written 6 books of stories and poems, and we're continuing. We have a bunch more work coming up.
Fantastic. So you were born in Torino, Italy, raised in
Yes.
Winnipeg, Manitoba, but relocated back to Italy several times until finally settling in Winnipeg in 1980. Talk about what makes Winnipeg special in your eyes and how deep and well-structured is the artistic community in that city.
Well, Winnipeg is actually a very kind of arty cultural city. At the same time, it's also kind of a frontier mentality, rough kind of rock and roll, hard drinking town as well. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I've always found it sort of very inspiring, and there is a heavy art and culture kind of base to the city. Lots of music. It's always been famous for bands, has great writers, great poets. The underground scene, as far as the underground writing scene, is lacking. But to be honest with you, Robert, I think that might be kind of global, or at least across Canada and the United States. The fact that there isn't much avenues for underground writers to come forth. But, I find Winnipeg cool and very inspiring. I got no plans to move out of here. It's really cool.
Yeah, from the pictures and the things I've looked at Winnipeg, man, it looks like a really cool city. So, hey, Tony, next week on June 5th, you'll be at Cole's Book City Place for a book signing. Talk about how special these appearances are for writers, and what do you personally want to get out of this experience besides obvious book sales?
Well, number one, I want to see My books sell more in other cities, and especially in the United States, than they do here. For some reason in Winnipeg, I mean, that has been common historically with writers that in their own town, you know, their own country, they don't do as well. But I'm trying to get a foothold here in Winnipeg as far as getting the word about my writing and Nicole's as well, just Screaming Skull Press in general. And also we like to promote other writers, other underground writers, you know, that we know sort of scattered across the world. I'm hoping that other writers from Winnipeg, if they even know about this, I mean, we've tried to promote it, will show up so that we sort of can talk about what we can do to kind of expand underground writing in the city. There's a lot of underground bands, you know, and there's a lot of like opera and symphony, sort of the high arts, but underground writing, there isn't much that I personally am aware of. I'm hoping through this that people will come out of the woodwork, you know, the dark poets, come on out, you know, I want to meet you, I want to talk to you, I want to get things happening in the city, you know what I mean?
Oh, that'd be an awesome, awesome thing to happen. You know, they say the prophet is never respected in his own home, so...
Never saw myself as a prophet, but I hear you.
Yeah, just to say that your books sell better in the U.S. and Canada. You know,
they do. Yeah, they do for sure. I don't know why. I have no idea why that is. Also, the same way most of my famous writers have always happened to be American. Not that I seek out writers from any specific country, but whenever I think of my top 10 or 20 writers, like 90% of them are American. I'm not sure if there's something in that culture that lends itself to sort of rebellion. I know that there is. United States is famous for it. And I think maybe that's why my books do a bit better, you know, in the United States and in Canada. There's a sort of underground, you know, the counterculture of the 60s and the punk rock that started in the 70s, the beat writers in the 50s. There's always something happening in the underground of the United States, not so much, you know, in Canada.
That's a good point. Tony, legend has it that at the age of 27, you traded your guitar for a Commodore 64 and started writing seriously. Tony, why did you go through this transformation at 27? And talk about some of the substance of some of your early writings. What did you write about in those beginning years?
Well, first of all, that was, I think, the greatest ripoff that a human being has ever done to himself, selling an electric guitar for a Commodore 64. I had a Gibson Les Paul, if you can believe it.
And Les Paul, oh my God.
Les Paul. I now have another Les Paul, but that was my original Les Paul that I played when I played in a bar band for years, and I traded it for a Commodore 64. I just got the bug. I was a musician, like, you know, a professional musician, low level B circuit bar band from the age of 19 to about 25. But even in that low level, like, we never went on tour. We were just local bands. I was already tired of the music scene. I mean, I could tell that this was not something, you know, that I could pursue in any reasonable fashion, you know, for a living or anything like that. And I got the urge to write. You know, I was always writing songs, and I got the urge. So I was always a big reader, you know, read the classics, all the underground stuff. And I just got this urge to start writing. I slowly started writing, and I realized I'm going to do this. You know, when it says started writing seriously, meaning I'm going to try to pursue this and try to make a living from this. And that was 1994, and I'm still not making a full-time living from it. But that was sort of the impetus. I wanted an art form that is more solitary, where you're not, you know, always debating with five other people the direction that this particular piece should go in. And writing works more for me. I'm semi-reclusive, and, you know, I dig it.
Yeah, they say.
Oh, and you asked sort of what kind of stuff I was writing in the early days. Well, my first six books were these little chapbooks, like 40-page books with staples on the side with stories and poems. And they're out of print now. And they're out of print because, well, I'm not that crazy about them. They were my first works, and they were very different from what I'm doing now. They were, like all writers, I started imitating my heroes at the time: Ernest Hemingway, Raymond Carver, Charles Bukowski. And it was all short sentence, very minimalist, you know, sort of street writing. In topic and subject matter, not much different from what I do now, but in approach and style and substance, completely different from what I do now.
So, Tony, speaking of your writing, you have graciously agreed to read some of your inspiring works on our show. Can you set up and read your first piece now for us?
Sounds good, Robert. Okay, this is an excerpt of my book-length poem called Last Stop to Saskatoon. It's a single poem. It's like 72 pages long, and I'm going to read a small portion of it.
Okay.
So here we go. This is Last Stop to Saskatoon. Death does not want you today. Death in the oceans, in rivers, and up in dank clouds of morning, in deserts far away, in dark forests without music, in barrooms with sudden laughter, in the minds of young and old in your neighborhood and across the water, death does not want you today. And that should be enough, and that should be all. But we continue. And I see the long, swooning, easy afternoon with towering gray trees mushrooming up top and red-purple leaves casting a shadow on the slick-paved, scarred-up sidewalks. My shoes beating that beat through the neighborhood like some old gangster flick full of machine gun tension. There at the end of my block on Garwood and Stafford Street, that air-conditioned 7-Eleven calling like a mirage on sun-scorched Easy Street. Right there, the sadness of it all hits me square in the jaw as common people do their common things, all beautiful and dead already. And the poets no longer scream in garbage-strewn alleys. And the teachers in nothing-doing classrooms realize the splendor and futility of it all. I accept that the end is just around the corner, always just around the corner. And with smile on face and those long-worn Beetle boots making that crazy sound on the sidewalk and rock and roll music as my guide, I get to it once again. To be free is the trick, ain't it? To walk among your fellow humans free of their ugliness and desires, to seek solace among the grief-filled rabble of Drunk Street and kiss them goodbye as they burn away, to spit in the face of all that's holy and the hell with the working class and their common triumphs, the hell with love and marriage and home, town and country, and politicians who live every day only to lie while taking your already dirty money and steering a hole right through the sky. Leave the family to turnstile, I say, and revel at the inside of your head with ideas of many colors and hobo smiles hanging from suicide ledge. Avoid the society suckers of today addicted to video game thinking and comic book realities that laugh at God and make those machines in your back pocket holy, you dig? The 20-something do-nothing boys shut into their brains of non-reality and cultural discretion. The filthy rich getting filthier with your psyche in a jaw on their mantelpiece beside all the other trophy killings. So, live like the indigo-depressed suburbs of your neighborhood got scorched away all at once and replaced by the midnight whorehouses of violent, gloom-drawn debauchery. Live like the final droppings of old age give way to long, easy afternoons on your front porch. Live like that shitty job you got dies suddenly and finally, and the bloodied skies open up, leaving the slavery of 9-to-5 dead on arrival.
Wow, Tony, that was beautiful. That was intense and poignant. But, man, I was with you every step of the way. Thanks for that.
Thank you, Robert.
So, Tony, you're welcome, man. Let's talk about a pivotal and life-changing time in your life, the soulful collaboration of you and your wonderful wife, Nicole. How did you two meet, and when did you both know that there was an artistic spiritual connection between you?
Yeah, this is a great story. There used to be this site, I'm talking about 12 years ago, I don't know if it still exists, called the Writer's Cafe, and it was for people like myself who had published stuff and wanted to maybe get it across to people, try to sell it, and also unpublished people to put their poems and stuff and get feedback. And I was trying to peddle my books on the Writer's Cafe and other sites at the time. I remember the original MySpace, I was trying to sell my books on there, which was ridiculous. But a common writer who I liked and who I corresponded with said, check out Nicole Sabella's work, introduced me to her, and I saw her work, and I was blown away by it, so I emailed her, and I introduced myself, and then she got a hold of my work, she bought a few of my books, and for about a year and a half, get this, we corresponded, at first as writers and people who were, I saw her writing immediately, similar to mine, not so much in style, but in sort of content and in spirit, this idea that it's going to be experimental, you're going to break the rules of grammar, and I don't care what the mainstream looks like, that sort of thing. And for the year and a half, slowly as we were communicating, we started becoming more friendly, and then from a long distance we fell for each other. So we kept corresponding in every single way possible, all the technology that you could possibly think of. We communicated every day for hours and hours and hours. And then in 2008, in June, she moved to Canada, and 9 days later, we got married, and here we are. We met and got married 9 days after we met for the first time.
Oh, man, that is so awesome. It sounds like a Sleepless in Seattle type story, man. You guys definitely need to put
that. It's kind of Shakespearean without the tragedy.
Yeah. You guys need to put that in a book, in a story, man. That is so pointed. So on your website, ScreamingSkullPress.net, in the About section, it reads, Searching for Rebellion. Two indie authors form Edgy Publishing Company. What does searching for rebellion mean exactly? And why is this concept so important to you, Tony?
Well, the rebellion is twofold. Number one, the rebellion against mainstream writing. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it shouldn't exist. I'm not saying that horror stories, science fiction, superheroes, and all that stuff shouldn't exist. There's room for everything to exist. But the complete dominance of our art and culture today of, you know, superficial sort of infantile writing like superheroes and vampires and all this stuff that usually were geared at 14-year-olds have now become the literature of today. And because of that, everything else has been pushed even more underground than it ever was. And I got tired of this a long time ago. And so the first part of the rebellious part is I am rebelling. Nicole is rebelling, and anybody who wants to be with us are rebelling against the fact that we want to offer an alternative, you know, the hell would offer. We want to challenge the mainstream status quo writing to do something more experimental, you know, to grow a pair, and to stop doing this formula stuff that is dominating everything. That's one side of the rebellious. The other side of the rebellious is, you know, rebelling against mainstream society, rebelling against everybody being the same, rebelling against the fact that young people now are sort of wanting to be already in their 20s. They're already sort of planning their future and bank. Like, there's no rock and roll sort of left, you know, so to speak, in kind of young people the way I see it. So rebelliously and culturally, you know, creatively sort of writing and culturally is the rebellion that I was looking for way back when I was a teenager. And then when I started writing in the 90s, and Nicole agrees 100%, you know, we need to challenge mainstream arts and culture to do better.
The website also states, and I paraphrase, Tony and Nicole have one question. Where have all the fearless artists gone? For the Beat Generation, controversy was the norm, not the exception. Creators like Jack Kerouac, William S. Burroughs, and Lucien Carr courted debate and made careers out of pushing the proverbial envelope with their poems, books, music, and other creative expressions. Living on the fringes of society was considered to be more exciting and fulfilling than conforming to the mainstream. And to that, I'll add the names Baldwin, Steinbeck, and Killens. So I'll ask you, Tony, where have all the fearless artists gone? What happened to them, guy?
You know, Robert, I could throw that question right back at you. That's a tough thing to answer. You could. I have no idea how. Maybe, you know, when the internet first came out, there was that sort of balance whether it was going to finally bring all this great talent that planet Earth had up to the forefront, or it was going to show that actually there's very little talent on planet Earth. And I'm afraid that it went the latter instead of the former. I don't know exactly. At some point in our popular culture, it went from seeking the next great artist to seeking the next big hit. If you look at the 60s, like, let's look at music. If you look at the 60s and 70s, the popular bands were actually the best bands. You know, there was always a healthy underground, but, you know, the Stones, the Doors, the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, the Clash, these weren't just the most creative bands in the world. They were also the most the most talented. At some point along the line, the most talented, the most popular became the less talented, and it's continued, and it's continued, and it's gotten more and more since the internet. And I don't know the exact answer to where they're gone. I still hold hope, though, Robert, that there is a large part of the world that wants to see, you know, underground writing, underground poetry become more popular. I correspond with a lot of writers across the world. We published for the first time, Nicole and I, other writers besides ourselves in an anthology called Howls from the Underground. We gathered we gathered a group of talented writers spread out across the UK, US, and Canada. So they are there. But again, as we touched on earlier, we're overshadowed by this, you know, this vacuous cultural kind of genre fiction, you know, common denominator
formulaic
junk. Like.
Yeah, formulaic. I understand. And you know, you threw the question back at me. And okay, you know, I'm going to take that baton. One of the things that I'm going to say is that back in the times of Baldwin and Kerouac, okay, there were 1,000 companies that owned TV stations. And there was easy ways to get your stuff into the hands of the public, all right? There were so many different outlets. Now, 4 or 5 companies rule the world.
And that's true. That's very true.
When 4 or 5 companies rule the world, then that cuts on a lot of freedom of speech. That cuts in a lot of freedom of expression and outlet. So, you know, right off the top of my head, that's one reason why I think there's not a lot of fearless writers out there. But let me ask you this question, Tony. Are there any artists today that you would put in the fearless category? And if so, why? And I'm not talking about you and Nicole. We know you guys are fearless, but are there anybody else?
Well, there is in the underground. We published some of them, as I said earlier, in our anthology. But if you go on social media, there's definitely a group of writers, some know each other, some don't, scattered around the globe that are doing that fearless thing, that rebellious thing, that experimentation. I'm not going to follow the rules. I'm going to do it my own way. But not many, Robert, not many. We're talking the internet has global reach. We're talking 7 billion people. This is not hyperbole when I tell you I know of about 30 writers that would fall out of billions, you know, millions. So it's still not healthy. But as I said earlier, I hold out hope that they're there. And I am trying to reach them. Nicole and I have this idea of cross promotion with writers, you know, like, you know, people of writers that are like-minded, that are, you know, along the same philosophies, do it all together. I mean, that's the only way it's going to happen. You're not going to do it on your own.
Yeah, man. You know, reach out. Exactly. Reach one and promote one. Definitely. So I was just curious, where did the name Screaming Skull Press evolve from?
Well, unfortunately, no great story there. In 1994, I published my first chapbook, and I don't even remember where it came from, Robert. I was just thinking of, you know, you don't want to put inside
the
chapbook published by me. So I just wanted to come up with a name. Screaming Skull sounded like something wild. It's, you know, no deep story, but it's a cool sounding name. I think it suits the, you know, we are screaming against what's happening in the mainstream.
Yeah, it definitely grabs your attention. So I thought there was a real, real big story behind that. So, but then again, Tony, I know you have another poem for us, and I know our audience would love to hear it. So let's do it.
All right, here we go. This is called The Night Shines in That Orange Streetlight Glow. When you look out windows at night through smoke clouds and tired eyes, and everything shines in that orange streetlight glow, and the rain-soaked skyline's barely visible in the gloom, when the distant lost wander the streets and hatred abounds and the steam from your hot drink hangs in the air, when you recede in your mind and all things fade, reaching back to happy times long gone, when the deep dark heart of Saturday night cuts a swath through your brain, when you realize some of the things people do just ain't right, and that some of those people are just like you, and the soft drone whisper says something ugly, and that a lone smile forms on your lips in the quiet, happy dark, when the sidewalk drinkers bend their elbows in the rain, when me and you lost forever meet under the boardwalk, when happiness sits coldly just around the corner, when puff number 23 feels mad, brilliant, and the words come easy, when the lost and righteous find something to do and touch themselves in all the right places, the moment shines bright for us, for you, and the long, cool night is alive as you realize that everything tastes better after midnight.
and touch themselves in all the right places. Wow.
Well, there are right places and wrong places.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. I love it. So, hey, Tony, let's switch gears and talk about the volatility of the business of publishing stories. How has publishing evolved since when you first started, and where do you see it heading in the future?
It's evolved incredibly. When I first started in 1994, home computers were still rare. The internet was just coming out, and as a matter of fact, in Winnipeg anyways, you had to go to an internet cafe or to the library. So my first six chapbooks and my first two novels were all done old school, as in I prepared them at home, I put them together, I went to the printer, I said, I want these pages to look like this finished book, and you had to print up 200 or 300 of them to make it even worthwhile your money. You couldn't do like you do now, one book at a time through a print-on-demand publishing.
Right.
And for promotion, I had to literally go to a bookstore, the library, write down addresses of literary magazines, and go to the mailbox and send tons of books out to them for them to review. So it was 100 times more difficult than it is now. Of course, the internet came and changed everything. It's become easier to self-publish, much, much easier, and with all the put downs that I always put forth about today's era, today's time, how I don't fit in and I prefer yesterday, there has never been a time where getting your word across and publishing your work as an underground writer is easier. So,
that's right.
Yeah, I mean, with the internet, with social media, and most of it being free, you can actually, this is what our goal, you can actually be a working-class writer, meaning you can make a working-class wage through your writing. I mean, if you bust your ass promoting it all side, it's not going to happen out of the blue. You can actually do it where 20 years ago, 30 years, that was absolutely impossible. You were either rich or you were poor. You know, there was no other way. Now, because of the internet, there's a middle ground. There's a million more opportunities. And I find it intriguing that with all of these opportunities, I still find so few of those, the kind of underground writers that you and I have been describing through in this interview.
So many readers, Tony, especially millennials, are reading stories and articles on their cell phones and tablets. With flash fiction and micro stories becoming more and more popular, it seems like the attention span of the reading public is getting shorter by the minute. Tony, do you think this radically changes the future of how we write and publish our books?
It does, and the attention span has definitely gotten short. I mean, I've read studies on it. Although I don't need to read studies, I can see it just with my own eyes. Shorter fiction, microfiction, flash fiction, shorter novels, shorter books of poems. That I'm not saying that's the way to go creatively, but that seems to be what the general readership is interested in. I think the future of publishing, I think the five big publishing companies that sort of dominate everything, They all have like smaller publishing companies that publish writers, but I think it's five big companies. I think they're going to disappear, and I think the future of publishing is going to be entirely self-publishing, which is fantastic, which is the way I believe it always should have been. I've never believed in outside editors. I find it appalling to think that I would spend, you know, whatever time I spend on a novel, and then somebody who doesn't even know me can sit down and actually edit it to their own ideas of what the public wants. I think that's ludicrous. The world, it's going to be self-publishing, music, books, and eventually movies. It's going to take longer for movies because it's so expensive to make a movie, but it's all going to be done by the artists themselves, and that's a good thing.
Tony, I'm going to take it a step further. I think that the technology in the future, and maybe even the real near future, is going to be so easy that we're going to also be able to make our own movies. Just like we can publish our own books, there's going to be technology where we can go ahead and make our own movies. It'll probably start with little mini movies in the beginning, and then it's going to be so easy we're going to be able to put bigger movies out there, man. I really see that coming as well. Anyway, in a time where hundreds of thousands of books are published every year, Tony, in so many different types of platforms, so many authors want to know how they can make their book stand out from all the rest. It's not an easy task. Tony, how do you handle this? How do you handle the marketing aspect of being an author?
That's a tough thing. There's this sort of thing in the underground right now, or maybe it was always there, where sort of, especially with the underground poets, where the word promotion or marketing is seen as a dirty thing, as a nasty thing. I mean, it's ridiculous, because if these underground poets researched their literary heroes, they were all great self-promoters. I mean, right now in the underground, sort of among poets, the god is kind of Charles Bukowski, right? That's who everybody wants to be and everybody looks up to. And he was one of the biggest self-promoters, you know, around. That whole drunken, nihilistic, I don't fit in anywhere poet, that was a shtick. It was who he was, but he amplified it and promoted it. And he wouldn't have half the readers he had if he hadn't done all that sort of self-myth, creating a self-myth around him.
Right.
You have to... If you're the kind of writer that is happy with just 10 people reading your book across the globe, then all the power to you. You have my blessing. Once you've written and published a book, your job is over. If you want to stand out and you want to get going, you have to hustle your ass. Now, Nicole and I are the types of writers that want as many people as possible to read our work. So, you know, I don't mean that in an ugly sort of commercial way. I mean, self-promotion is not selling out. Selling out is if you do something stupid, like wear a dress on a talk show that has nothing to do with literature and bob for apples just because you think you can get into public eye. That's selling out. Trying to promote your work because you believe that there are people out there that would like to see it and because you like what you're doing, that there's nothing dirty about that. And I will also add that I think there needs to be, and I mentioned this earlier, a cross-promotion. Robert, if you look at through history,
right,
if you look at the sort of cultural underground movements that came to the forefront, it was always a group of artists helping each other. Look at the counterculture of the 60s. All the musicians, you know, the Stones helped out the Beatles when the Beatles were first starting out, and the bass player for the Animals went to the United States, saw Jimi Hendrix playing in a club, and said, I got to make this guy famous, brought him back to England. The beat writers who carried each other's writings, you know, hitchhiked across the country and all had each other's writings and all bragged about each other. Punk rock movement in the 70s, the Lost Writer generation in the 20s, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, Fitzgerald. I'm hoping, I would like to make this happen right now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Algonquin Club in the 20s,
exactly,
back there in New York City, man. That was big, where everybody was helping each other and promoting each other. And, man, there was so much talent that came out of that. And also, as I was telling you, the Harlem Renaissance with Zora Neale Hurston,
right,
and Wallace Ford, and you know, Wallace Thurman, rather, and Langston Hughes. Like, it's always been that way, you know? But Tony, let's – go ahead, sir.
Well, there seems to be a resistance to it now, and I don't know why, but there seems to be a resistance in working together. At least I have felt resistance, and I'm actively trying to meet other like-minded writers that have the same ideas as myself, like, you know, every day trying to go out to meet and say, you know, how can we help each other? But I'm not getting much. There is a handful that I'm working with for sure, but we need more. You know what, Robert, I'm throwing the gauntlet out right now. Underground writers of the world, unite.
Yeah, you know, so let's talk social media, such as Twitter and LinkedIn. Of the social media platforms, Tony, which one do you feel is the most beneficial for your brand? And which, in your estimation, is the best for authors? Or does each platform offer its own special compensations?
Well, we only use Twitter and Facebook, and Facebook not even that much. I would say Twitter by far. I want to say right off the bat that I'm not the biggest fan of social media. As a matter of fact, Robert, if it wasn't for us trying to push Screaming Skull Press out there, we would not be on social media. You know, I just want to make that clear. However, for underground writers who want to get – underground artists in any medium who want to get their work out there, you have to be an idiot not to use social media, and especially Twitter. We went on Twitter – we were relatively new. I think 3 years ago we started on Twitter, maybe four at the very most. I'm not – exaggerating when I say our sales doubled, maybe even tripled since we got on Twitter.
Wow.
We met, no exaggeration. And we met, like I said, this handful of strong, what we believe to be really strong underground writers, yourself being one of them, by the way. And
right.
I would suggest all writers use Twitter to the max. I mean, don't bother people and send them individual image, you know, in individual emails every day. But on your page, I mean, don't be afraid. Have rotating, you know, go for it. Twitter is absolutely the best for underground artists.
To me, a lot of social media platforms are all about narcissistic self-promotion. Buy my book, check out my blog, use my editing service, etc. I'm looking for more pay it forward, help each other experiences, as we talked about. What's your take on this, Tony?
I agree with you 100%, and that's a fine line to straddle. And Nicole and I struggle with it as well, because we try to do sort of, remember, we have 19 books combined. Well, 18 books,
right.
Just me and Nicole, and then we have that anthology, which is 19 books. So for us to keep those going, we have a rotation on our Twitter page. And sometimes we say, you know, I hope, you know, what if this is pissing people off? Although I don't really care if it's pissing people off. But it is a fine balance, you know, because like you said, yeah, a lot of it is buy my book, blah, 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 blah. You got to sort of trust your own instinct and hope that you're not overdoing it. And also what we do before we tweet any of our stuff, any of our books, we go through Twitter and we always, and I challenge anybody to show me otherwise, retweet a whole gang of other writers and painters,
right,
and filmmakers that we like before we put our books. Because like I said, we need to create a cohesive underground movement, you know, with everybody writing in different styles, but with one voice, which is to challenge,
right,
mainstream status quo literature.
In closing, excuse me, I have an interesting question I'd like to ask you, Tom. If you could have a conversation with Tony Nesca at 20 years old, what would be the most important piece of advice you would give him?
Oh, my God. First of all, 20-year-old Tony Nesca, to nail him down on a seat and try to put any sense in his head at all would have been futile at best. I got to be honest with you, Robert. I have gone down exactly the path that I've wanted to go down on. I think 20-year-old Tony Nesca was on the right path. I started off wanting to be a full-time professional musician, switched to wanting to be a full-time professional writer. I am not a full-time professional writer, but I am a professional writer.
Right.
I would tell him, stay the course, man. Don't party too much. Stay the course, and, you know, you're doing good.
Stay the course. I love it. So, Tony, if people want to get in contact with you, can you give out your website address and any other contact information?
For sure. Webpage is screamingskullpress.net. You can contact us on there, and you can just look us up on Twitter, right, in Screaming Skull Press, or Tony Nesca or Nicole Nesca, or on Facebook, and, you know, we answer emails very promptly. As a matter of fact, I answer email communication quicker than I answer phone call communication.
This has been the Author's Lab with me, Robert Batista. My stories, The City Game and My Baby Has No Name, which are fearless stories, just as Tony talks about, can be read for free online at Booksy.com. My guest has been the entrepreneur, poet, and all-around fearless human being, Tony Nesca. Thank you so much, Tony, for being my guest on the Author's Lab.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
It's been a blast. Have a great evening.
Right on, man. You too.
Bye now.
Bye.